Call the Senate Judiciary Committee meeting to order. It's today is, what is it, the 19th today? 19th at 1:37. We have Senator Kelly, Senator Costello, Senator Wilkowski, and Chair Coghill. Today we have Carrie helping us out over there, and Max making sure that we get everything on the record properly. Today we're going to bring up Senate Bill 151. That the court system has asked for, and then we're going to go look at House Bill 208, which deals with trust issues. That's the trust bill going through the legislature, which I understand has a companion in the Senate, but here we are with a House member jumping ahead of the Senate. We'll see how we deal with that. My intention today on both of these bills is to let them have their initial hearing. And then I think at least on the Senate Bill 151, which is the number of Superior Court judges, I intend to probably bring it up Wednesday and move it along, unless there's questions that the judiciary has a hard time answering, which we could try out today. Nancy Mead is here with the judiciary system and the other branch of government that we like to pick on. Welcome, Nancy. The nice thing about this is we got a prelude to this from the State of the Judiciary. The Chief Justice brought this to our attention and actually explained why he wants to do this and gave us a pathway. So most of us at least got the high view, the top end view. So now we get the details. So please put your name on the record and present Senate Bill 151 for us, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nancy Mead. I'm the general counsel for the Alaska court system, and I want to thank you. I'm very appreciative. The court system as a whole is appreciative that you're hearing Senate Bill 151 today. Very briefly, what this bill accomplishes, and the only thing it accomplishes, is increasing the allotted number of Superior Court judges by one and specifying that that additional seat will be in the first judicial district, which is Southeast Alaska. And as I'll get to, this bill has a zero fiscal note. So just preliminarily, this is a bit different from most of your bills in that it's being proposed by the judicial branch, the Alaska court system. So in that sense, it's like a governor's bill, although I want to be clear, it's not a governor's bill, but it's introduced by rules by request, like governor's bills are. But it is the court system that is the sponsor, and I have the privilege of carrying the bill on the court system's behalf. As you are also aware, we don't often propose legislation. We don't seek statutory changes because making law typically involves policy decisions that are within the purview of your branch. And in fact, the last time we had carried a bill was in 2011, 7 years ago, and it was to amend this very same statute to allow for two more Superior Court judges, and at that time it was for Anchorage, those two spots. And you may also wonder why we need to come to the legislature for this. Typically, the court system handles its own staffing changes or classifications of employees because those are administrative matters, internal matters, how we assign people to do different work within the court system. But this situation is unique. AS 2210-120, which is proposed to be amended, establishes the number of Superior Court judges. And the reason it does that is because the Constitution requires it. Under the Constitution, the number of judges of the Superior Court is set by law. So that is what brings me here today to get that changed and why the Supreme Court is asking you to pass this bill. That is not true, by the way, for judges of the district court, which will become important as I explain how we intend to do this. Again, as Mr. Chairman said, and what's made it simple for me is that you already heard from the Chief Justice in his State of the Judiciary address a little bit about this. The Juneau Superior Court is overburdened with casework relative to the number of judges, and it's been this way for a number of years. It has, as the document I supplied shows you, the second highest number of Superior Court case filings per Superior Court judge. Now, the first one on that chart that I provided is Anchorage. Anchorage does have a higher number of Superior Court filings per Superior Court judge, but in many ways that's not an apples-to-apples comparison. In Anchorage, we did get two new judges in 2011, and those judges are functioning fine. They are adequately staffed for now at the Superior Court, because what they have is economies of scales and additional resources that a small court like Juneau doesn't have. So if you have 17 judges on a Superior Court and somebody goes on leave and needs somebody to cover for them, another judge can step in much more easily than what we have in Juneau with just two Superior Court judges. So comparing those caseloads really doesn't tell the full story about what type of work and how much work the judges have. So since this in Juneau, the court's overburdened, it just means that we're seeing, despite the judge's best efforts, that cases can be slowed down or delayed, and it's difficult to schedule hearings, and the written work products are just taking longer than the court system is comfortable with coming out of Juneau. And the court has had this problem for some time. In 2014 and 2015 and 2016, we had a capital budget request for an additional courtroom to be constructed in Juneau, thinking that that would at least facilitate visiting judges coming here and being able to have proceedings at the same time as the sitting resident judges here. And those requests were not successful. So to alleviate the problem, what we've been doing for the last several years is more or less redistributing some of the Juneau Superior Court caseload. Specifically, mostly, it's the presiding judge of the First District who sits and lives in Ketchikan, who has taken over a good portion of the Juneau caseload. He takes one-third of the civil cases filed in Juneau, all the administrative agency appeals that are filed in Juneau, and in addition takes a couple, one to two, larger felony cases that will result in trial days. So if there's a 1 to 2 week trial, that's a lot of disruption to a judge's schedule. He travels up here and holds it and presides at those. And that's just because he has an expansive sense of responsibility towards his colleagues and to the public, and he makes that work with his other Superior Court judge in Ketchikan, and they shift the work and accommodate it that way. Now, he does a lot of his hearings by video, but you can't from Ketchikan, but in a lot of instances, the judge and the party simply need to be in the same room. And, of course, while he's doing that, his assigned cases in Ketchikan don't stop, and what it means is, really, he's working hours and on a caseload that's just not sustainable. He works every weekend, and this is not something, although a stopgap measure, that the court system wants to continue. It's not a fix to the problem. So this sort of untenable situation the court has known for a number of years needed to be addressed, and what's happened now is it's the right moment to do that because of other circumstances. Right now, Juneau has two Superior Court judges and two District Court judges, a 2-2 model, you might call it. And now one of those District Court judges, which has lower jurisdiction, has announced plans to retire at the end of this fiscal year, June 29th or 30th, I believe. And the Supreme Court thought that this was an opportune time to just fill that seat with a Superior Court judge. So instead of having 2 and 2, we would look to have 3 and 1, and the new judge would simply take over the existing seat for that district court judge. So just to back up a tiny bit, you're probably already aware that the Superior Court judges have original jurisdiction over anything that's filed in the state, whereas a district court judge has only limited jurisdiction. Generally, the Superior Court can handle felonies, domestic relations, child in need of aid cases, and civil cases where the amount being argued about is over $100,000. Now, the district court, by comparison, can only handle misdemeanors. They have domestic violence protective orders, civil cases where it's less than $100,000, such as small claims, and minor offenses. So, and then just to finish that up, a Superior Court judge can do all district court work, but not vice versa. So the district court judge here can't help with the Superior Court backlog. By filling this seat with a Superior Court judge, they'll be able to do everything, and we can address the problem at the level at which it's occurring. So with this staffing model, the number of Superior Court filings per Superior Court judge would obviously drop, and they would, you know, be better equipped to keep up with their caseload. And in fact, it would put the numbers at almost exactly what we have in Kenai. in terms of both the Superior and District Court. Now, the District Court work won't suffer either, because these three then Superior Court judges would have to do some District Court work. That's not unusual. For example, in the Second Judicial District, we don't even have any District Court judges. Those Superior Court judges do everything that comes in the door, whether it's a district or Superior Court level. That's true for the judge in Sitka, for example, who does all the Superior and District Court case filings. We don't have a District Court judge there. So not unusual at all. And that also, we have in Juneau a magistrate judge. Now, a magistrate judge does whatever's assigned, but for these past number of years, the individual in that position has been doing what we call master work, helping the Superior Court with preliminary hearings and whatnot in China cases and cases where they don't have jurisdiction to make the final decisions, but they can ease the load on the Superior Court. With this change, that magistrate judge would transition into more typical MJ duties and would take on all the minor offenses, for example, traffic tickets and things like that. And so the District Court remaining one judge would be helped from both sides, both the Superior Court and the magistrate judge. And again, with the change, the one District Court judge would have almost the very same number of case filings as the Kenai District Court judge when you take away minor offenses, which are a whole different time commitment. They're usually very fast and a little bit easier to handle when you think of a traffic ticket, for example. So I've talked about the caseload impacts and how we kind of see this as a winning solution, and the timing is right. And the real reason the timing is right is because it's allowed us to submit a zero fiscal note. And that is because we can do this with existing resources. Now, there is a difference in salary between a district judge and a Superior Court judge and mandatory benefits. That amounts to about $35,500, and the court system has decided to absorb that cost through savings we're going to have to realize in some other way in the coming years. But typically when we ask for a judge, and why we didn't ask the past few years, is it costs about $500,000, because a judge usually comes with a chambers, often a capital expense, an in-court clerk to assist in the courtroom. Sometimes there's increased security, and DPS may have a fiscal note. There's a law clerk, there's a judicial assistant. But here, since somebody's retiring, that new judge will literally use the same chair and computer and resources and in-court clerk. We do plan to have the Superior Court judges, the three of them, share two law clerks. District judges don't typically get a law clerk. So we aren't asking for another law clerk for that position, and they will share the existing judicial assistants who do the secretarial and other assistant work for the judge. So it's not unprecedented for Superior Court judges not to have one dedicated law clerk. And with this decrease in the caseload, the Juneau judges, the presiding judge, and the Supreme Court think that two law clerks will be sufficient for the three Superior Court judges, should the bill pass. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions and address any thoughts that the committee has.
Thank you, Nancy Mead. Questions at this point? Senator Wilkowski, and then we'll get to Senator Costello.
Yeah, thank you. good to see you, Nancy. I don't know if this was provided by you, or I know my staff did some research, but it's the court system annual report, FY, was that from you guys? Or
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. It's not from me, but I'm very familiar with that document. It's on our website.
Okay, so, and we just pulled it up, looking at table 6.05. It's just filings per judicial position, and then it's got, for example, Anchorage Superior Court 11,000, District Court 38,000. And that's not per position. Is that, that's a total amount? And that, but because then in the last column, it's got filings per judicial position, and it's got 1,267. Is that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I don't have the document in front of me, so I'm not sure exactly what page you're looking at.
Senator Wilkowski, maybe I could have the staff go ahead and make a copy of that real quick.
Sure. Thank you.
And if there's another question while we're waiting for that copy?
Maybe wait for that, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Senator Costello, and then we'll get back to Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Nancy. Through the chair, appreciate the fact that the court system is always absorbing costs when you have when you see costs come up, and I think that's something that is worth mentioning because it's not common amongst departments to see, you know, you stepping up, not that the court system's a department, but consistently stepping up and finding ways to, you know, work with less in these challenging times. I was just curious about the wait times for cases to be resolved. Do you have information on that, and has that changed over time so that it's taking longer?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, thank you for the remarks about the fiscal responsibility. I'll pass those on up to the budget folks. I don't have data on time to dispositions. It's always more complicated than data would show. For example, that the Superior Court judges here may not be slower in the total overall time to disposition of a felony case because, for example, there are rules about how fast you have to handle things. But it's harder and harder for parties to get scheduled, say, on a domestic relations, a divorce hearing. I mean, some cases have absolute deadlines. The child in need of aid cases and felony cases at the Superior Court level must be heard within certain timelines. Now, many times the parties waive those for their own reasons, but we have not run into a problem where criminal cases had to be dismissed because, you know, the Rule 45 deadlines weren't met or anything that specific. What we have found is a general dissatisfaction with the ability to schedule things and the ability to sort of get the interim motion decisions out the door.
And so what are those timelines that are in statute? Could you remind me what those are?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, for the child in need of aid cases, there are many federally imposed deadlines for having a case brought to what's called permanency, and those are tied to funding, actually, for the Office of Children's Services, so it gets a little bit complicated, and I don't know them off the top of my head. They are in federal law, and they are also written in the court's child in need of aid rules. Now, I do say that those deadlines are in federal law, but parties can agree to extensions under certain circumstances, and that is not uncommon to have happen if more study needs to be done, or in the child's best interest, it makes sense to wait in some cases. In felony cases, the court has its criminal Rule 45, which has a 120-day timeline. Now, you're probably as aware as I am that that is often not met, not because the court isn't ready to hold a trial, but typically because the parties need more time to prepare the case for trial, and it's a system-wide issue. For example, the state crime lab may not have DNA test results ready in time, or the police reports aren't typed up and provided to both parties in time. So very often, of course, felony cases are not resolved within 120 days, but what happens at every single felony hearing is that the parties talk about, where are we in Rule 45? What's going on with this? If you want a continuance, are we waiving Rule 45? How does the victim feel about this, and is this justified? So it's something that everyone's aware of and works towards, but is not always accomplished because of logistics in a particular case.
Thank you. So there's really no consequences for not following that? And then can you also talk about, if this were to pass, will that help in that situation or not really, because we're just taking we're you know, moving one judge from a district to a superior court level?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, we hope that it will help move cases along generally in a faster way because hearings can be scheduled. Now, as I say, felonies, the consequence it's typically something that the parties waive. For example, if the defense needs extra time, they're going to say, I need extra 2 months, and, you know, they wouldn't get it if they didn't waive the Rule 45 counting of days, but it's something that everybody's aware on and works towards. If it is not met and somehow we have a Rule 45 failure, the case gets dismissed. That's extremely rare because, I don't know if we have one a year. I kind of doubt it because it's something the parties are always talking about and aiming for. But if both parties agree that a continuance is needed so that there's due process and everything's met, then it's generally granted by the court system.
Thank you. And just one final question.
Yeah, Senator Costello.
Does the court keep information on what types of cases that are heard throughout Alaska, and is that something, if you do keep, have you kept that over time so we can see any trends that might be occurring?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, the court system's website has our administrative reports from the last, well, I think we started posting them in maybe 06. I'm not certain of that, but we do, as required by statute, a large document with all kinds of data, and you can try to see trends. We never answer the question why certain case types might be going up and down, but cases are always going up and down. And so I could point you to that website. I could provide more information to your office afterwards. I also will hand you after this a little pie chart that I prepare for myself about what types of cases and the percentage of a caseload is handled in the different courts.
Do you happen to know off the top of your head what the landscape is in Alaska with cases? I mean, are we seeing more criminal? Or are we seeing more child in need of aid? Or is that something you can just generally talk about?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Costello, yes. One of the things in preparing for this, I will tell you that in Juneau, the number of probate cases has gone up 70%. From 2013 to 2017, and the number of child in need of aid cases has gone up 60% during those same 4 years. Statewide, the child in need of aid cases have gone up about 50% in the last 4 years. Felonies and misdemeanors go up and down. Last year, we had a lower kind of an ebb in the number of misdemeanors. Now we're seeing an increase in the number of felonies, nothing that is hugely remarkable or steep, but it's kind of in the normal ebb and flow of things. We're also seeing an increase in the number of felony trials, which does make a big difference. It's just different ways that cases come up and different ways that the criminal justice agencies, mostly the Department of Law and the Public Defender, are handling their cases.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good information. Nancy, would you like to take a moment to look at the filing? Do you want me to take a brief at ease while you just kind of peruse that, or do you recognize this well enough to proceed?
I believe I recognize this well enough to proceed.
Senator,
thank you, Mr.
Wilkowski,
Chairman.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and please ignore my chicken scratch on the left-hand side there. This just seemed to me somewhat helpful in trying to figure out what's going on here, and I just wanted to make sure I understood it correctly. Just looking at Anchorage, for example, those are raw filings, correct, for Superior Court, District Court?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, that's the number of files that come in the door per Superior Court judge.
Okay. And then in the last column, it says file. And this is, by the way, if anyone's interested in looking at it, it's Alaska Court System Annual Report FY 2017. It's a public document put out by the court system, just in case anybody wants to look it up. And it's table 605, but the last column is filings per judicial position, and is that judge, district court judge, superior court judge, magistrate? Is that how that's calculated? Do you know?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I think pages right around this also talk about the magistrate judge's position. That may include also the magistrate judge position.
Okay.
That I mentioned Juneau has one of, and Anchorage has, you know, maybe a dozen.
Right. And again, I'm just trying to get a general sense. I apologize for not having the whole document here. But looking at the next one, for example, Angoon, is there a district court judge there?
There is not through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, there is not a district court judge in Angoon.
Okay. So when it says District Court 19, is there a magistrate there then?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, there is not in Angoon. What there is the judicial positions in Southeast have a traveling calendar. So Angoon is covered by Judge George, who's based in Sitka. So Judge George covers Sitka, Angoon, and Prince of Wales. Both district and superior court in those locations, if that's helpful.
Okay, gotcha. And I'm just trying to get a general sense of how many people are where. So the numbers, so the filings per judicial position, where if I were to go down to Sitka and it says 987, would that include the traveling judge hearings in, say, Angoon?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, it does not. So you'd have to add up all the things that they're covering to get a better but still incomplete picture of the actual caseload. For example, you could take that Sitka number and add Angoon and Prince of Wales to come up with a better idea of how much work that judge has. But you also have to take into account that travel takes time out of a person's schedule, so that's a little bit tough in that regard to actually compare how much work somebody's doing to handle a certain case.
Okay. If I could, Mr. Chair.
Yes, does Senator Wilkowski.
Does the Juneau judge travel? Are there other, I assume there's some travel involved?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. The Juneau judges on paper do travel. One judge covers Juneau, Yakutat, and Haines, and the other covers Juneau, Puna, and Skagway. However, over the past couple of years, those have been the presiding judge has tried to alleviate, knowing their caseload, has tried to alleviate that travel by either taking it himself or offering it to that Sitka judge and seeing if maybe it can be filled that way. And so they are trying to minimize the travel for those judges, the Juneau judges.
Senator Wilkowski.
So then on the Superior Court judges typically get a law clerk, and the District Court judges typically do not get a law clerk.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, correct.
So what's the plan going forward on the Juneau Superior Court position? Because it's not funding a law clerk, correct? I mean, how much is a law clerk? It's got to be 100 and change, I would assume. What's the plan going forward? Just that's going to be absorbed into the budget?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we are not seeking a law clerk at all at this time for that new position. So right now there are two law clerks because there are two Superior Court judges, and with a third judge, there will still be the same two law clerks. There's no additional money needed for that. Now, everyone thinks that's going to work because once they get the third judge, their caseload is going to drop quite a bit. They will no longer be in the top five. They'll be towards the bottom. So the two law clerks should be able to handle the work for the three judges. If in a few years things change and this is somehow an unsustainable model, which nobody thinks, we could, without coming to the legislature, of course, just hire a law clerk and use a PCN from another vacated position to make that happen. Law clerks, by the way, are considered temporary employees, so they don't cost as much as you may think. There are no benefits or payments into PERS, and I think the amount is closer to in the high 60s.
And then
Senator Wilkowski.
Would that be the only Superior Court judge in the state that doesn't have a law clerk then, this position that we're
through the chair, Senator, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, no, the two Ketchikan Superior Court judges share a law clerk right now, and the presiding judge in Anchorage does not have a law clerk, and often a law clerk takes his or her next job early before the actual end of their one-year term, and accommodating judges will say, sure, if you have an offer, you can leave 4 or 5 months early, in which case the judges, particularly in a place where there's multiple judges, share law clerk resources in that way.
Okay. And then
one last question.
Yeah. So is there a national standard for the number of filings there should be for a judicial per judicial position?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I don't think there are. Courts are so different across the country that it's hard to say. For example, you can't say the number of filings, even in district court. If you can't truly compare a domestic violence protective order petition with a fish and game citation. It's hard to compare and know what people are up to, so that there aren't standards that I'm aware of.
Other questions? So for me, I went and looked at the statute, and we actually did at one point line out how many magistrates and district courts, but I see where Rule 19 under administrative rule gives you really the authority to do it. However, so I guess the question for me, Ms. Mead, is this going to be a downward pressure that makes you want to go out and get more magistrates? I know economically you're going to be stretched anyway, but is that probably where the pressure relief is going to come, or do you think that this is going to contain that pressure?
To the chair, the absolute hope and expectation is that this will not cause pressure anywhere, that it's actually going to alleviate the problem, that by those Superior Court judges, as I say, will do some of the district court work, and the existing magistrate judge will stop doing is much superior court work and step up to do the minor offenses that come into the district court. So we don't expect any sort of a ripple effect to other courts in Southeast Alaska from this change. And then just to address your first point, there is a statute on district court judges and magistrates, and that has not been modified in 30 years because the statute included a new subsection C. I think maybe the legislature stopped caring about that. And the statute says the number of judges, district judges and magistrates can be set by the court by rule. So it was more or less a handing over of that, and that's how we set the district court judges because that's not constitutional as the Superior Court judge number is.
Yeah, I mean, so in reading the Constitution, it said it would be determined by law, and that was the law way of dealing with it, is turn it over to the rule, the court, which may or may not be the best way, I don't know.
To the chair, the Superior Court judges are set by law under the Constitution.
I'm talking about the magistrates and district courts.
They are not. They are not discussed in the Constitution, so those don't have to be set by law.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Well, no, it said we would make the courts according to law policy, right? So I think that's where that got me to search, and that's all. And then I began to wonder if we do this in the Superior Court, is that going to open up a way that magistrates would start to do more of the work, of preliminary works? I think they already do a lot of the arraignments and things like that, if I understand correctly. So just looking to, for my understanding, make sure that we're not creating a bubble that actually shows up somewhere else. That's all. That was my only thought.
Okay, and to the chair, I appreciate that, and I think that we're expecting just the opposite, to sort of contain the pressure and provide resources where they're needed without hurting any of the other case handling that's already ongoing.
That's good. I mean, other than that, I think the numbers in the bill are pretty straightforward. We're just going to have a 43 Superior Court judges in six will be in the First Judicial District. Pretty simple. I mean, as far as statutory rule goes. Any other questions for Nancy Mead? Nancy, thank you very much. And I don't see any other testimony, so I think you have got the 25 minutes worth of questions. So thank you very much, Nancy.
Thank you.
My expectation is I'm going to set this aside today. We'll get a chance to bring this up again Wednesday. I'm going to leave public testimony open on this. If there's anybody that has input on how we'll deal with the First District and their Superior Court judge, we'll look for it. If not, I'll probably bring it up and bring it up for a vote.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nancy. So with that, we're going to set Senate Bill 151 aside, and we're going to bring up House Bill 208, which deals with trust and powers of appointment. And we have Representative come and speak to it. So it's a House bill that has a Senate bill companion by Senator Costello. So put yourself on the record, Representative, and introduce the bill, and we'll go from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Delana Johnson. I represent House District 11. This bill I respectfully offer to you for your consideration, House Bill 208. This bill increases the flexibility of existing trust law, restoring Alaska's place as an attractive trust placement environment. With me today is my aide, Andy Evans, and Mr. Richard Hompesch, who is an attorney specializing in trusts. I plan to stay, but I may just need to step out for my resources committee. So I would like to turn it over, hand over the presentation now to Andy Evans.
All right, for what we'll do is we'll...
If I may.
You sure may. Let's go ahead and take a brief of these, and we'll get people up here in my... call the Judiciary Committee back to order. Now we have presenting for us the Senate House Bill 208. What I'm going to do is there's a presentation that they're going to have up for us, and I have a little IT problem because normally we have it on one screen in forward and one in the back. We just haven't got the back screen yet. But in order to save time, we're going to go ahead and roll forward. And why don't you introduce yourself and give me your presentation. And when you speak, go ahead and whoever's speaking, introduce yourself again so that our records can keep track of who's speaking.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andrew Evans. I am staff to Representative Delana Johnson.
And why don't you go ahead and...
Yes. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Rich Hompish. I'm an attorney in private practice in Fairbanks, Alaska, with the firm Hompish, Evans, and Averett.
All right. I do have a little presentation here. Now, just to be clear, do you want me to proceed with it?
Please do.
As we do? Okay. So with the passage of the Alaska Trust Act in 1997, the state transitioned really to a top choice for the placement of trusts. The law made Alaska a strong choice because it effectively eliminated the rule against perpetuities and because it allowed for protection of trust assets against creditors of the beneficiary. Now, when those benefits were added to the fact that Alaska had no income tax, we became an attractive location to place trusts. Since then, however, the trust market has evolved, and several other states, New York and Nevada most recently, have passed legislation to keep up with those market demands. Now, Alaska has been in the top three choices for housing trusts, but is currently ranked number eight. House Bill 208 updates, clarifies, and increases flexibility in trust regulation while maintaining the relevant protections that currently exist. Oops, I'm getting ahead of myself here. Maybe. So what does this bill do for Alaska? First of all, it promotes increased investment in Alaska's economy and opportunities for growth in our financial service sector. The second thing, of course, is that it expands an industry that is not natural resource extraction dependent by attracting non-resident trusts into the Alaskan financial institutions. Third, it will create more higher-paying jobs. Accountants, attorneys, trust professionals, and others are necessary for the prosecution of the trust business. And finally, it does provide revenue to the state. Registration fees and life insurance premium taxes will bring in roughly between $7 and $12 million annually. Now, it's important to consider that the base components of this bill already exist in statute. HB 208 simply expands the flexibility of these components. And they can be categorized really in four areas: decanting of trusts, powers of appointment, traceability of assets, and specific powers of a trustee. Now, I have a rather elementary definition of decanting a trust here.
That's where most people's mind goes.
What I'm going to do is turn this over to Rich Hompesh here for a few minutes just to go through these four pillars and explain them in better detail.
Thank you. Put yourself on the record, Rich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Rich Hompish. I'm an attorney in private practice in Fairbanks, Alaska, with the law firm Hompish, Evans, and Averett. And as the illustration suggests, decanting a bottle of wine is when you take wine from an old bottle and you put it in a new bottle. And by analogy, that is the way trusts are decanted. You take the assets from one trust, the invaded trust, and appoint those assets to a second trust called the appointed trust. Now, why would someone want to do that? Well, I've recently been to the Heckling Institute on estate planning in Orlando, and a person expert in this area, a dynasty trust, tried to draw an analogy between a Model T Ford and a Tesla. There's a big difference in options when you think about automobiles in that light, and trusts have evolved in a similar fashion. Now we're, well, we started the turn of the century with trusts that continued for roughly 90 to 110 years. Now Alaska law allows trusts to continue for 1,000 years. So what things do we need to have in trusts for the future? Well, we're not really sure because the laws, taxes, and other laws may change, but flexibility is really the key. And if a trustee can take the assets from one trust and distribute them to another one for one or more of the same beneficiaries, that leaves a lot of options to satisfy the needs of the beneficiaries going forward.
This would be for both Andrew and Rich. Do you want to take questions as we're in the middle of this, or do you want to wait till towards the end? Because we will have questions arise, and I was just asked that.
Mr. Chairman, I would prefer to get through the presentation and then move back to slides if you would do that.
That's all right with the members of the committee? All right. We'll just go just write your questions down. We'll get to them. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Go ahead, Andrew.
Through the chair, I'm going to have...
Put yourself on the record when you're...
Oh, I'm sorry. Andrew Evans, staff for Representative Delana Johnson. I'm going to have Mr. Hompesh briefly go through the changes to the decantation process under this bill, changes to powers of appointment, changes to traceability of assets, and changes to trust powers.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is Rich Hompesh. I'm a trust and estates attorney in Fairbanks, Alaska. And the changes to the decanting statutes, I think can be summarized simply by saying that the new decanting, or HB 208, sets forth a more efficient system for decanting and clarifies a lot of points that under old law raise questions. For instance, the decanting is effective 30 days after notice is provided to the settlor, person have the right to remove the trustee and at least and a qualified beneficiary under House Bill 208. It clarifies that the beneficiaries may waive the notice requirement, and instead of a beneficiary, at least one beneficiary has to be notified, and also that the trust instrument may authorize the trustee to exercise the decanting power without notice to beneficiaries. And that's important because a lot of settlors want set up trusts that are silent. And under AS 136080B, under Alaska law, I can put money in trust and waive the trustee's duty to notify any beneficiary of the trust for the shorter of my death or adjudication of my incapacity. So those are called silent trusts. So in that case, I could provide that the decanting can go forward without notice to a beneficiary.
So, and just to let you know, Andrew and Rich, that when we get to the sectional, my guess is that will probably come up for a little further discussion. So, please continue.
So that's an overview of the changes to decanting. The changes to the power of appointment, first let me define a power of appointment. A power of appointment is when a person has the power to distribute or to give assets to another person. The AS or House Bill 208 provides that a non-fiduciary who has a power of appointment, that is someone who's not a trustee, cannot be compelled to exercise that power of appointment in favor of a creditor of the person holding the power. And that's something that has not been clarified under Alaska law to date. The changes to those specific...
Before we get there, and I hate to do this to you in mid-sentence, but I'm going to take a brief at ease. We have a cable that is loose on our PowerPoint, so... I need to check that out real quick. So we're going to take a brief of these while we do a little technology hunting. there. It looks like we're not going to get that technical thing fixed up, so we'll just limp along without it. I was only doing it for the chairman's benefit, and so it's pretty hard for me to hold up the whole committee just for that. So, Rich, you were stopped in mid-sentence or mid-thought. If you want to go ahead and back up get us back on track. Sorry.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This is Rich Hompish. I'm an attorney in Fairbanks, Alaska, who practices in the area of trusts and estates. I was describing, I think I finished what is a power of appointment and what is a non-fiduciary power of appointment in Section 1 of House Bill 208. There are changes to the trustees' powers, and specifically Section 2 of the bill allows the trustee to insure property of the trust against damage or loss and to insure the trustee against liability with respect to third persons or beneficiaries of the trust as well. The traceability of assets is sometimes important when a trust is involved in litigation and for purpose of settlement in a divorce case and other situations. When two settlers or two people start a trust, sometimes the trustee needs to trace the assets back and divide the trust in that way. And now we have a statute in this bill that allows exactly that. And I think that's a good overview.
All right.
Of House Bill 208. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. First question was going to come from Senator Costello, if I understood correctly.
Yes, thank you. I thought it might be important to sort of go back up to a higher altitude to just answer some basic questions because, I'm familiar with the bill, and I've heard it in committee before. I am the sponsor of the Senate companion to this. And I thought, I'm just listening to your presentation, and I thought there were some questions that came up in previous hearings that I thought were really illustrative and able to shed some light on, why this bill is important. And so I do have a couple questions. One of them is, I think it's important for the public and the committee to know who uses trust, like what Alaskans are, involved with trust, because I think there's a perceived notion of who has trust in the state and who this bill is affecting, when in fact, when that question was asked before, it's a lot broader than what I think most people think. So could you let us know who in Alaska is, has a trust? Who are the people that will benefit when this bill passes?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, when Alaska repealed the rule against perpetuities about 22 years ago, I didn't foresee the fact that over half of our clients who reside in Fairbanks want trusts or want their estates held in trust for the benefit of their children and other descendants. And it's mainly because of their concern, I guess, about the tsunami of divorces that every family is facing today. If assets are in trust, the legislature has provided that they're not subject to any kind of division upon divorce. So that's an important reason. The other one is you never really know when one of your beneficiaries might have a financial problem of some sort. Divorce is just one financial problem. So that's surprisingly a lot more Alaskans, working Alaskans are interested in trust than I ever thought. And of course, there's a lot of wealthy families from the East Coast and elsewhere in the U.S. who decided to form their trusts under Alaska law just because our law is more flexible. In the last 22 years, we've tried to become, as Delaware is to corporations, we wanted to be Alaska as to trusts. And I think we've succeeded in large part.
What about parents who have children with special needs? Is that another group of Alaskans who are accessing trust as a way to ensure that their children are taken care of? you know, once they're gone?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, absolutely. You never know when you're setting up a trust if your grandchildren are going to have medical or other special needs, and if your estate plan says distribute outright to grandchildren at a certain point, that grandchild might very well lose all his or her benefits under state and federal law, and putting the assets or allowing it decanting to a special needs trust for the benefit of that disabled grandchild is real helpful to a lot of Alaskans.
And then I have a question about the connection to Alaska. Are there requirements for some of the assets to be in Alaska, or do they not have to be in Alaska? Does one of the beneficiaries have to be in Alaska? Can you describe to the committee what the connection is with Alaska, if there is one?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, the legal term is nexus. The trust has to have a connection to Alaska, and under existing law, at least one of the trustees has to be a resident of the state if it's he or she's an individual, or a corporate trustee whose principal place of business is in the state. And that person has to have certain powers, like the power to arrange for the preparation of tax returns, has to maintain some of the trust and records of the trust, or books and records of the trust on an exclusive or non-exclusive basis, and some of the administration has to occur here. None of the beneficiaries have to live here, and the person set up the trust does not have to live here. But oftentimes, of course, that is the case.
Thank
just,
you.
Just for the committee's benefit, Douglas Blotmacher is with the Peak Trust Company. He is also available for questions. And then we have Matt Blotmacher, who is also with the same company in Anchorage, and then Abigail O'Connor, who is the attorney, Holland and Knight. Both of them in Anchorage, and both of them listening in asked to be up for testimony, and if we can get some of the questions answered, I'll probably get them to testify in that order, so probably in the next 10 or 15 minutes. Two of the questions I have, if the members don't have any further comments or questions. So on the decanting, you're moving your assets, basically, of that trust into another model, if I understand. So are you moving it within the state from one type of a trust to another, or help me understand a little bit about putting it into a new trust, what that might look like? Because it my first question was, what's the nexus to Alaska? Do they move their trust out if it's what I wrote my note down here is venue shopping, basically. You're looking for a better outcome for that trust. Is that based on the investment strategy, or is that based on the laws, or is that based on the customer's request?
To the chair, usually or typically the trust formed under the laws of another state is imported to Alaska. And then, and when Alaska trustee is appointed, the trust is registered under Alaska law. And then the trustees would have the power to decant under the Alaska statutes. And so then the decanting occurs typically from one Alaska trust or trust that was foreign, is now governed by Alaska law, to another trust governed by Alaska law. So the form shopping occurs when the customer or a client wants to decide, you know, what is the best state to locate my trust, have it administered, which state's laws are the most flexible, which trustees offer the most competitive services, and that occurs before the actual decanting.
Okay. So the laws that we're putting in place under this, the new rule, it looks like they'll be able to take advantage of a little more ease of movement to a different style of trust, maybe an upgraded venue. Would that, from Alaska's perspective, is that attractive, or is it an open door for them to move out? just maybe I'm misunderstanding how you characterize it.
To the chair, in my experience, the trusts that come, that are moved, imported to Alaska and then decanted under Alaska law, stay in Alaska.
Okay.
Now, all trusts have a change of status provision that allows somebody to move the trust to another jurisdiction. But if you have a jurisdiction that accommodates all your legal requirements, you know, and is competitive in price and service, you know, why leave?
Yeah.
And I think that's the position Alaska's in today. And House Bill 208 furthers that goal.
Thank you. Obviously, I got to come back up to speed on this because I've looked at this in prior years, but it's pretty dense for my dense head. And then the insurance requirements that you had talked about previously. Explain to me the context of what is insurance capacity we have now and what's new in this bill. You were talking about adding the insurance requirements.
Yes, to the chair. Every trust has, well, I'd say 99.9% of the ones I've reviewed always have a list of powers that the trustee, or sometimes as many as three or four trustees, has a list of those powers. However, Alaska Statutes 1336.109 lists specific powers of trustees, and they're not all inclusive, and one of the existing powers is to ensure the property of the trust against damage or loss, and to ensure the trustee against liability with respect to third persons. The addition is to allow the trustee to insure the trust for claims by beneficiaries of the trust.
Okay. So you're just dealing with the legal challenges that happen within the trust, basically.
To the chair, yes, because litigation is expensive.
Yeah. All right. That makes sense. And then the traceability of assets was another question that I had. And I'm asking the questions based on my ignorance, I'm sorry to say out loud, folks. But on the traceability, the assets that are currently placed in a trust, it looks like you're allowing the ownership to divide is what it looks like. So, explain that a little better to me. So I might have miscued on what the traceability.
To the chair, Section 23 of House Bill 208 allows a trustee to divide a trust into separate portions for income tax purposes. So this okay. New provision provides that unless a trust prohibits this division, if the trustee keeps records tracing contributions made by different settlers to the trust, then the trust can be divided for income tax purposes on that basis.
Okay, that makes more sense. Somehow I missed for income tax purposes, so that helps me. Any other further questions? Maybe we can get a couple of people up to testify at this point. I'm going to go ahead and have both Abigail O'Connor and Matt Blotmacher come before us to give their public testimony first. That may cause us to dig a little deeper again, if you don't mind, unless you have some more, Andrew, that you want to chime in on.
Mr. Chairman, no, that would be fine.
All right. Well, why don't we go to Abigail O'Connor, who's in Anchorage, and we'll have you come up, and then we'll get Matt Blotmacher right after that. So, Abigail, why don't you put yourself on the record, your affiliation, and give us some testimony on this trust bill.
Good afternoon. This is Abigail O'Connor. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Holland & Knight in Anchorage, Alaska. I also am licensed and do practice in the state of Florida. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak. This bill, as Mr. Hompish said, does create more flexibility and creates more opportunities, and specifically for decanting. If I, just to give you an example to compare it to Florida, Florida has a decanting bill as well, but it's very restrictive compared to the Alaska bill. So if I have a trust in Florida and I would like to decant it, because Florida has a 360-year rule against perpetuities, so that's still a very long time. And I'm trying to say, okay, I need to decant this trust into something new, but I can't do it here. That would be a great opportunity to change the situs to Alaska, which would require an Alaska trustee and moving some of the assets, which clients typically, if they are trying to get something accomplished that needs decanting, then they're open to moving to a venue that allows them to accomplish what they need, then that could be a good opportunity to move the trust to Alaska and take care of the decanting. In terms of, you know, keeping the trust here, there was a question about will the assets stay in trust. I agree with Mr. Hompersch's response, and that is that, you know, one of the goals of this legislation is to allow Alaska to continue to be and to improve its desirability for being a trust situs and location. And so I think that's what we would look at in terms of moving trust assets into an Alaska trust and then whether or not to keep them here. So the goal is to make Alaska a place where people would want to move their trust and keep them. And that sums up my contribution.
Thank you, Abigail, very much. And I see Douglas Lautmacher also, who was available for questions, also be available for testimony. So, but let's go to Matt Lautmacher, and then we'll let you go ahead and give your testimony, and then we'll go to Douglas if you want to, or if you want to speak in tandem, just make sure that you identify yourself when you speak. But we'll go to Matt first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of our committee. This is Matt Lautmacher with Peak Trust Company, and I can keep my testimony short unless there are specific questions for myself or the organization. But, you know, to follow up on what Rich and Abby have said, you know, we believe this bill continues to put Alaska in a great place as far as a jurisdiction where not only Alaskans but non-Alaskans would want to do their planning. And it's good for Alaskans. It's good for Alaska. And we appreciate you considering this bill.
Thank you, Matt. Appreciate you taking the time to testify. And I know with you and Abigail, now Douglas, this is a significant part of the trust world in Alaska. So, Douglas, I want to go ahead and give testimony, and if any new information or any help that you can give us, but mostly your testimony on this. So put yourself on the record, Douglas.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Douglas Blotmacher, and I'm President and CEO of Peak Trust Company, headquartered in Anchorage, Alaska. I know there was a comment asked about, you know, assets into Alaska. One of the requirements is that some of the assets have to be in Alaska. And through our organization, we have about $80 million on deposit with local banking institutions. And that's a constant $80 million. So therefore, there's a lot more money that the banks have to lend and to, you know, keep the economy going. So it has been very beneficial to Alaska and Alaskans. And I greatly support this legislation and think it will be advantageous for Alaskans and Alaska.
Thank you very much, Matt, and thank you for your work in bringing those assets into Alaska and for the people of Alaska and their trust needs. What we're going to do at this point, I think, unless there's questions, I'm going to, now that we've brought the questions open before us, we'll give people a chance to look at it from the committee perspective. We'll come back Wednesday. We'll probably get down into the sectional. So that now that we have the concepts and some of the explanation, maybe some of the words will make a little more sense to me, because when I read them, I probably did miscue on a few of them. So I think what I'm going to do is hold it over until Wednesday, and unless there's somebody here, including Rich, by the way, for, thank you for coming all the way to Juneau from Fairbanks, unless there's somebody who can't be here Wednesday who needs to say something, I'm going to just hold it over. Is there any questions from the committee at this point? Please go ahead, Richard.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to be here in person on Wednesday, but I think Doug Blomager mentioned some benefits to Alaska. There's others as well. We have one of the lowest premium taxes on life insurance in the nation, and people typically buy life insurance, set up a trust in Alaska, buy a life insurance policy in Alaska, and then the premium tax is paid to the state of Alaska. And that, my understanding, that's brought in millions of dollars in revenue to the state of Alaska. In addition, very often these trusts in Alaska own Alaska limited liability companies, or rather the assets of the trust are owned by limited liability companies formed in Alaska. And going back to 1997, my understanding is that only very rarely did someone who did not live in Alaska form an LLC under Alaska law. Now there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people from outside Alaska who come up here. In addition to creating an Alaska trust, they also form an Alaska LLC, and that's revenue is $250 filing fee to the Department of Corporations plus $100 every year biennial tax. And so that's additional revenue for the state. In addition, there's a filing fee of, I think it's now $40 or $50 that when each trust is registered, that's a fee paid to the state of Alaska to register the trust. So in addition to the employment, there's also some revenue for Alaska, the state of Alaska specifically.
Excellent. We're glad to hear about money being in Alaska and staying here. Well, thank you. I think at this point, we've probably put ourselves to the point where the questions really need to be pondered a little bit from my perspective anyway. So, Andrew, any last words before I hold us over?
I would just like to thank the chairman and the committee for hearing us today.
All right. Thank you. Well, with that, I'm going to hold this bill over until Wednesday. We'll bring it up for further questions. And for those who can be available, the Blotmachers, Mr. Holmstedt, if you can be available by phone, that would be probably helpful. And so other than that, I think you're pretty straightforward from what I can see. So, but you've caught me at a place where I don't even know the next question to ask, so I'm going to have to go back and do some more studying. With that, we're going to hold this bill over to Wednesday. The two bills come before us Wednesday. That will be the extent of our meeting. Then I'll explain to you what we're going to have the following week in front of the committee, all right? With that, we'll adjourn this committee.